The world's most prestigious and expensive sailboat race, the America's Cup, begins Monday off the coast of Valencia, Spain. The Cup has a 159-year history going back to the days of wooden schooners, and it's no stranger to controversy. As NPR's Scott Newman reports, this year's competition throws out tradition and steers yacht racing into uncharted waters.
First, the boats. They're a lot bigger and twice as fast as previous America's Cup class yachts.
It's completely different sailing these boats.
Russell Coutts, a veteran New Zealand sailor, is skipper for the American entry.
They're much, much faster than the old monohulls, and that's because they're so much lighter and so much more powerful.
America's Cup yachts have traditionally been monohulls, a single sleek shell piercing the water. This time, both competitors will sail multi-hulls for the first time. Think Polynesian outriggers on steroids. The U.S. Challenger Team BMW Oracle hopes its giant three-hulled trimaran can unseat Swiss defender Alinghi's equally large two-hulled catamaran.
It's been a game where both sides have been trying to develop their boats to go as fast as possible in a straight line. I don't think you're going to see as many maneuvers, but I think you're going to see much higher speeds.
By design, catamarans and trimarans are faster. But to push the envelope even further, both boats carry high-tech foils that help lift them out of the water to minimize drag. They almost fly over the surface. BMW Oracle also sports a super-efficient rigid mainsail that's similar to an airplane wing stood on its side. Critics argue that such departures fly in the face of tradition and threaten the very character of the competition. That, along with a two-year legal battle over the race that tossed out the rule book, has turned off many fans, says Gary Jobson, the president of U.S. Sailing, who has crewed for five America's Cup teams.
This is not a tactician's race. This is Buck Rogers.
Jobson says fans can forget about the exciting upwind tacking duels, where the lead yacht tries to force an opponent to sail in its turbulent wind shadow. That maneuver requires tight zigzagging patterns these new boats aren't very good at. And that's not all that rankles purists. Gone, too, are the muscular crew known as grinders that handle the winches. The new rules allow powered winches. They also permit movable water ballast that can be pumped from one hull to another to stabilize the boat, doing away with the need for crew to hang over the side to shift weight. Again, Gary Jobson.
I think those things don't help sailing and takes the athleticism away with the electric winches, the movable ballast. I'm not in favor of those things at all.
But others argue that the America's Cup is all about innovation and producing the fastest boats possible. Like it or not, they say, multi-hulls represent the cutting edge of yachting. Grant Simmer is Alinghi's design team coordinator.
We're nearly always sailing at speeds between 20 and 30 knots, so just the sheer speed of the boat and the images both coming off the boat and from helicopter shots will be really exciting. Sure, it's different, but I think it certainly for the sailing enthusiasts, it'll be really interesting.
Even so, both sides have hinted that they could rewrite the rules and go back to an open monohull challenge in future competitions. Scott Newman, NPR News.
And one final note from the world of business. Sun Microsystems CEO Jonathan Schwartz resigned today, and he did it over Twitter. Not only did he do it in fewer than 140 characters, he did it in haiku. Financial crisis, stalled too many customers, CEO no more. Schwartz's departure was expected. Late last month, regulators approved Sun's sale to rival Oracle, and the joint company has a new boss. Schwartz has been quiet about his future plans. On his blog, he urged followers to stay tuned to, you guessed it, his Twitter account.
Telecommuting has become so mainstream that more than one-third of companies now allow employees to do their jobs from home, like, say, if they're snowed in. NPR's Adam Hochberg discovered one company where employees do not have any choice. They must all work from home.
There's no longer anything novel about the way Laura Shoppy does her job. Each workday, she goes upstairs to her office above the garage of her rural North Carolina home. And surrounded by her two dogs, Zoe and Bella, she runs a multi-million dollar company called Fuentech that helps its clients commercialize new technology.
So, this is my desk.
Okay, so I was going to say you keep this a very professional environment. Then
Except
I saw
for the dog bed.
Then I saw the dog bed in the back.
While it's not unusual nowadays for people to work from home, Shopee's company takes the idea to an extreme. All 40 people who work for Fuentech are required to telecommute. Shopee calls Fuentech a virtual company with no traditional office at all.
When I started this in 2001, right from the start, the idea was that it was all going to be home-based. To create a brick-and-mortar environment really wouldn't have provided any better service for our clients, and it really wasn't what we were looking for.
Shopee says the decision was a practical one at first. When she founded the consulting firm with just two other people, they saw no need for formal office space. But as Fuentech grew and began hiring engineers, technical writers, and others, she found they were more productive when they worked from home and set their own schedules.
I think you get better loyalty. I think people are more willing to get the job done. And part of that was that flexibility of allowing people to have their personal life or their family life be primary.
Completely office-less companies like Fuentech are rare, but working from home is growing more popular at all kinds of employers. A 2008 survey by a consortium called World at Work found that some 17 million Americans telecommuted at least part-time. Consultant Marianne Perrin, who helps employers adopt flexible work arrangements, says telecommuting has become common in companies large and small.
As they look at their business growing, this bricks and mortar that's going to have to grow along with it is extremely costly, and they've realized if they can take more advantage of telework, that they can have a significant impact on the bottom line.
Perrin notes, though, that a successful telecommuting strategy involves more than just packing up an employee's stuff and sending him home. New teleworkers may need to go through training, both on technical things like how to use remote software, and on lifestyle issues like balancing work and family. Supervisors also might need training to manage people they can't see. University of Maryland professor P.K. Cannon says his research has found that about a third of people who can telecommute rarely do so, often because they're afraid their boss won't like it.
It seemed like there was some stigma associated with telecommuting. Some people are saying it's a career suicide. If you're out of sight, you're out of mind, so I really don't want to telecommute even though I could.
So we do focus in right here, experience working in a virtual office.
Fuentech, the company where everybody works from home, tries to screen out job applicants who harbor negative feelings about telecommuting. Jack Spain, who handles recruiting, uses an electronic questionnaire.
Sometimes I can find that this is going to be someone that's pretty needy. They're looking for that. Well, okay, I'm okay with sort of working virtually, but how am I going to get in touch with you on a regular basis? You know, that sort of stuff.
And that's a red flag if you think they're going to be too needy?
Yes, it is.
Spain says Fuentech has had few problems with its workforce of home-based professionals, but he concedes that telecommuting isn't for everybody. Some workers, he says, tend to thrive on the camaraderie, meetings, and structured hierarchy of a traditional office job, things that can't be replicated at home. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Those of you who live in an area with limited internet access, here's some news. The government wants to hook you up. The Obama administration's stimulus package includes just over $7 billion to extend broadband access where it's not widely available. But so far, only a fraction of that money has been given out, and some applicants for the funding say major telecom companies are trying to block those projects, as Joel Rose reports.
One of the first grants to be awarded is going to a project known as the three-ring binder.
It is three large fiber optic rings that cover the entire state of Maine.
Fletcher Kittredge is the president of GWI, an internet and phone company in Maine that was the lead sponsor on the application. Kittredge says it will extend what's called middle-mile infrastructure, bringing high-speed internet access to rural parts of the state that currently don't have any.
The analogy we use up here is this is kind of the main turnpike of the telecommunications network.
Kittredge's company was part of a coalition that applied for and got $25 million in federal money to build the three-ring binder. The group includes the University of Maine and other local internet companies, but it does not include the state's biggest internet provider, Fairpoint. In fact, the company helped write a state bill aimed at blocking parts of the plan. State Representative Stacy Fitz introduced the bill, which would prevent the university from offering broadband to private customers.
we have entities like the university that are supported by the state that are potentially in direct competition with folks that are out there trying to eke out a living in the private sector.
Fairpoint, which declined to comment for this story, is in bankruptcy. But Fletcher Kittredge at GWI says rather than trying to fight the project, Fairpoint could be using the new fiber optic lines to deliver broadband to more people.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a threat. If they involve themselves in it and fully understand what the opportunities are for them, they could really make a lot of this.
But so far, few of the nation's biggest internet providers seem to be taking that advice.
They aren't leading, they aren't following, and they won't get out of the way.
Craig Settles is the author of Fighting the Next Good Fight, a book about broadband business strategy. He says the nation's biggest telecom companies have generally decided not to apply for federal stimulus money.
They're not going to put proposals on the table because they don't like the rules. Yet they're not going to cooperate with the entities that are going after the money.
Settle says that's in part because the grants could force those carriers to share their wires with competitors. But there's been no shortage of smaller companies and municipalities that are applying for the stimulus money. The National Telecommunications and Information Administration has received more than 2,200 applications. Several of them came from a coalition of community groups and city government in Philadelphia. The city's chief technology officer, Alan Frank, says the application, which so far has not been funded, calls for more computers in libraries and rec centers in the poorest neighborhoods, as well as free wireless access in outdoor public spaces.
We don't expect to be providing the same sort of speeds in those public spaces as you can get when you pay. We're trying to focus on, let's just call it, the neediest of the needy.
But it's the free public space wireless that's drawn an objection from cable and internet giant Comcast. The Philadelphia-based company filed comments about the city's plans with the NTIA. The comments themselves are not public. Comcast spokesperson Senna Fitzmaurice says her company is merely pointing out that it already offers broadband in Philadelphia.
We said that the applications that should have priority were areas that were unserved rather than areas that are already served by a commercial competitor.
Comcast and other big internet companies have filed thousands of such comments on applications across the country. NTIA Press Secretary Jessica Schaefer says it's impossible to say exactly how much weight those comments carry.
The fact that there's an existing provider that offers some level of broadband service somewhere within the project's proposed service area does not disqualify the project from funding.
The NTIA has given out less than $300 million so far. Most has gone to grants that focus on unserved rural communities, like the Three Ring Binder in Maine. But Todd Wolfson at the Media Mobilizing Project in Philadelphia wants to see more help for underserved urban communities, where broadband is technically available but still too expensive for many residents.
This city, one out of two do not have internet in their home, and they can't afford it. We need to solve this problem.
A second round of broadband grant applications is due in March. Wolfson says his group and the city plan to apply again. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
Online relationship rules are still being written, but there's one rule that has made an easy transition from the analog to the digital world. Sex sells.
As we continue our pre-Valentine's Day All Tech Considered, we're going to hear now about a romantic comedy that never made it to the big screen.
But it has been watched by millions on desktops and laptops.
Okay, you understand. We don't want boyfriends. We don't want boyfriends. We don't want relationships. We want two guys to service us. This is strictly sexual.
The name of the film is Strictly Sexual. It's about two working professional women who've given up on relationships and decide to employ a couple of gigolos to fill the void.
Really, the movie is about love and intimacy. And if I were to title the film Love and Intimacy, I'm sure people would think it was pretentious and never watch it.
Director Stevie Long adds that it's not a porn flick. In fact, there's no nudity in his film whatsoever.
Yet Strictly Sexual is the most watched movie of all time on Hulu.com. No stars are in it, and even though it never had a theatrical release, Long got it into the hands of a company that distributes films on cable and the internet.
I woke up one morning and found a dozen or so messages in my Facebook inbox, you know, saying, hey, I just saw this film and, you know, it really touched me and I love the way it talks about breakups and relationships. And I just kind of scratched my head saying, where'd you see my movie? You know, I had no idea actually what Hulu was. God bless, you know, the people who had the foresight to put it up there.
Hulu, for those who still don't know, is an incredibly popular video streaming website. One online measurement service, ComScore, reported that more than a billion videos were watched on Hulu in December 2009 alone.
It carries some movies and a lot of popular television shows, Lost, The Office, Family Guy. Long figures that people stumbled upon his film on Hulu while catching up on their favorite TV shows.
We were hoping, you know, in a perfect world that, you know, it would open on 2,000 screens, that, you know, a Harvey Weinstein would put it all across America. We were fortunate in that the timing of the internet and the ability for people to watch movies came about at the same time. I didn't have an ego about it. As an artist, I just wanted my movie to be seen.
Hulu won't provide an exact view count for Strictly Sexual, but there are enough people watching to make Stevie Long a profit through commercials embedded with the movie.
I'll give it to you in these rough terms. The film, the $100,000 film, has made 10 times its money.
Enough to fund Long's next independent film.
It's a tragic tale. It's about people in the porn industry and the denial that goes on there. We've appropriately titled it Porn Star, The Ugly Life of a Beautiful Girl. And I'd like to think a lot of people are going to click on that title.
Whether they click on it or not, Long has already proven that the internet is a place where independent filmmakers can thrive.
If the title is right. Don't forget to go to our All Tech Considered blog, where you'll find quirky tech stories you can't help but read.
That's npr.org/alltech. This is NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Blau.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The video game business is built on sequels and franchises. Grand Theft Auto 4, Rock Band 2, and endless iterations of Super Mario Brothers and Madden Football. Today, gamers can fire up their PlayStations and Xboxes with a franchise that is 700 years old. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on the video game Dante's Inferno.
First, the Cliff's Notes. The Inferno is a 14th century Italian poem by Dante Alighieri. In it, Dante imagines himself taking a journey through the depths of hell.
He's fundamentally mapped hell with this poem.
Jonathan Knight of Electronic Arts is the executive producer of the video game.
He's created a visual topography, and there's a tremendous amount of structure and geography and weather and monsters.
The poem lays out 9 circles of hell. Each circle has souls guilty of a particular sin: lust, gluttony, greed, and so forth. The punishments are symbolic of the sins. Gluttons must lie in slush because of the garbage they made of their lives on earth. Dante is guided through hell by the Roman poet Virgil. By the end of the poem, Dante has a deeper understanding of the Christian idea of sin. But to turn this poem into a video game, producer Knight says his main character had to be more active.
Our reimagined version of Dante is a warrior, he's a fallen crusader, he's fighting his way through hell.
And doing it for love.
Bridges!
I have to go with my love. I gave my word.
In the game, Dante goes to hell to free his great love, Beatrice. Along the way, he kicks butt, killing suffering souls. This is a far cry from the poem, which is filled with philosophical discussions and monologues about life and death. A few Dante scholars have bristled at the liberties the game takes with the Inferno, but a lot of Dante scholars don't play games. Jonathan Combs Schilling does. He's a 6-year graduate student at UC Berkeley who spends hours hunched over Dante texts, mulling over its intricate meanings. When he relaxes, he enjoys killing monsters, playing his favorite game, God of War. Finally, a game that gives him monsters and Dante.
I mean, he's a poet, and that is his... I'm actually going to find it hard to talk about the cultural worth of Dante while killing these heretics. So. But I will happily get back to that.
Combs Schilling loves certain scenes, like when Dante crosses the river Styx into Hades on the back of the ferryman Charon.
There are a couple moments where the landscape is close to being similar enough to something along the lines of how I had imagined Dante's description, that it's a little bit exhilarating.
Through me, the way to everlasting peace.
"Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," is among the most famous lines of the poem and among the few that actually make it into the game. Combe Schilling says a lot gets lost when you're going from epic poem to video game.
In a certain way, we're not even talking about Dante's Inferno. It's a kind of a mashup of certain aspects of it.
It's part of a long tradition, Combe Schilling points out. Dante's classic poem inspired great works such as the illustrations of Gustave Doré and Franz Liszt's symphony. Combe Schilling thinks making a video game of the poem is like composing music inspired by it.
Because fundamentally it's not a narrative in the way that a movie or a text, a work of literature is.
Combe Schilling does have some reservations about the message of the game. Dante justifies a lot of killing to save Beatrice and to eventually redeem himself.
The way the game is structured, you feel okay doing the abhorrent things you do.
Despite the liberties taken by the game, Combe Schilling has no fear that Dante's 700-year-old poem will last and probably inspire many more interpretations. There's also a special print edition of the poem being published with pictures from the game that producers say might draw fans to the original. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.